You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Brookings. My name is Marvin Kalb, and I have been privileged today to be asked to introduce this program and also serve as a kind of moderator. So I'll be the guy asking Bruce Rydell questions. And we are here, all of us, to celebrate the publication of a first-class book called JFK's Forgotten Crisis, Tibet, the CIA, and the Sino-Indian War. And I'm happy to tell you there are copies right outside. And you can also rush right after this and buy at least two. This is a very special book and a very special moment for me. I was, in 1962, Bruce, the CBS Moscow correspondent. And I hope that you will forgive me, but I was totally absorbed in another crisis that was taking place at that time. It was called the Cuban Missile Crisis. And those of us in Moscow were 99.5% absorbed with either the coverage of that story or asking questions about what are the Russians up to. In those days, it was, what is Khrushchev up to? And today we ask the question, what is Putin up to? And that is one of the issues that's going to be raised in our discussion today, the applicability to the degree that there is between what we have learned from the 1962 Sino-Indian War and ways in which that can be applied to our knowledge of what is going on today. Also, at that time in 1962, I did have one ear cocked to news about the Sino-Indian War because my brother, who was right here with us today, Bernard Kalb, was a journalist for CBS covering that war, something I doubt any other person in this room was actually doing. So let us start first with hearing from Bruce. And what I would appreciate, Bruce, is tell us as an opening, what is the theme of the book, the important points, what is it that you were attempting to do?
Great. Well, first of all, thank you, Marvin, very much for being prepared to do this. Thank you for bringing your brother as well, and thank all of you for coming. Let me begin by setting the stage for you a little bit about this crisis and this war. On the 16th of October, 1962, or just about 53 years ago, McGeorge Bundy, John F. Kennedy's national security aide, came into his office early in the morning in the West Wing and opened his top secret folder. Every day, the National Security Advisor gets a top-secret folder put together by the White House Situation Room of the most important cables and events that have gone on overnight. On the 16th of October, McGeorge Bundy had two very, very important cables in that folder. One was an assessment from the State Department about the situation between India and China. And the State Department warned that the border conflict between India and China was heating up rapidly, and that it increasingly looked likely that China and India would find themselves in a full-scale border war sometime in that month. The State Department also told the president that should that come to pass, the Chinese would almost certainly prevail because they were better equipped, they were better led, and they had more experience recently in fighting. And that if they did prevail, India would probably turn to the United States for assistance, requiring a major presidential decision, not just about assistance to India, but also how that would balance with America's very close relationship with Pakistan. The second memo in McGeorge Bundy's overnight folder was from the Central Intelligence Agency, and it reported that U-2 imagery taken 24 hours earlier had found intermediate-range ballistic missiles being introduced by the Soviet Union into communist Cuba. And it began the Cuban Missile Crisis. Like many people, You focused on the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think the vast majority of Americans focused on the Cuban Missile Crisis for good reason. It appeared to be an issue in which the survival of mankind was at stake. And in fact, it was an issue in which the survival of mankind was at stake. We thought back in 1962, many Americans, many Russians, many Europeans, many people around the world thought the world was on the brink of Armageddon. In fact, it was closer than we thought. At the time, for example, the CIA estimated that there were 5,000 to 8,000 Soviet soldiers in Cuba. We now know there were 50,000 Soviet soldiers in Cuba. At the time, the CIA thought there were only intermediate-range ballistic missiles. We now know that the Soviets also brought with them tactical missiles capable of firing nuclear weapons at relatively short ranges, and that they had surrounded Guantanamo Bay with a battery of these, and the battery commander had pre-authorization to start firing nuclear weapons at Guantanamo Bay when the first bombs dropped by the United States on the island. So that's how close we were. But that shouldn't dismiss from our eyes the other crisis, the crisis the State Department was writing about and warning about. And the State Department turned out in this case to be remarkably prescient. China did invade India, and it quickly got the upper hand. And within days of the Chinese invasion of India, Prime Minister Nehru had to do one of the most difficult things in his entire life. He had to turn to the Americans, and even worse, to the British, for assistance. And at the end of October 1962, the United States and the Royal Air Force began an airlift of urgent supplies to India. We had eight Boeing 707s landing every day, each one of them dropping off 20 tons of equipment for the Indian Army. And we had American C-130s flying them to the battlefield to try to stop the Chinese invasion. And the State Department was right about something else. The Pakistanis didn't like it. Pakistan was then the most allied ally of the United States. They weren't just members of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. They were members of the Central Treaty Organization. We had alliance requirements with them that specifically said we wouldn't sell arms to India without consulting with them first. And pretty soon in this crisis, the Pakistani leader, Field Marshal Ayub Khan, began complaining to the American ambassador and writing to Kennedy and saying Pakistan deserves some kind of compensation, as he put it, for staying neutral in the war. In effect, signaling that if it didn't get what it wanted, and it was pretty clear what it wanted Kashmir, it was prepared to open a second front, which was, in the end, the nightmare scenario of both President Kennedy and Prime Minister Nehru. The Chinese then stopped and then started again. And when they started their second offensive, they overwhelmed the Indians completely. It appeared for a brief period of time in mid-November 1962 that the Chinese would not only take over the border area, but would in fact take over all of eastern India, the whole part of the country to what is now the east of Bangladesh. Remember, of course, in 1962, Bangladesh was East Pakistan. There were even fears in India, and the CIA had the same fears, that the Chinese would open another front, occupy the tiny principality of Sikkim, and then march down the border of what was then East Pakistan to Calcutta. On the 19th of November 1962, Nehru wrote two letters to President Kennedy. In the second of those two letters, he said catastrophe was imminent. Let me just read you two sentences from this letter. "The situation is really desperate. We have to have more comprehensive assistance if the Chinese are to be prevented from taking over the whole of eastern India. India faces a catastrophe." And he went on to ask for the president to send urgently 350 American combat aircraft and the crews to fly them and the radar installations to make them work in order to launch an air war against China. Nehru's request was that the Indian Air Force would bomb into Tibet at the supply lines of the Chinese and the American Air Force would defend Indian airspace. But in fact, he was asking the United States to enter a war with China. Now, if you think about President Kennedy's position, here he is. He is, on the one hand, dealing with an issue of the survival of the human race, the most tense moment in this U.S.-Soviet Cold War, and at the same time, he's now dealing with a request from the world's largest democracy to the United States with assistance to fight the world's largest, most populous country on the other side of the world. Talk about multitasking. This is multitasking at its probably highest art form. Fortunately, 36 hours after Nehru's letter was received in the White House, the Chinese unilaterally stopped. Why they stopped, whether that had always been their intention to stop, are questions we don't know the answers to. We don't have access to the Chinese records. We have access to a lot of American records and a good deal of Indian records, but we don't have access to the Chinese records. They stopped. At the time, the president didn't know. Was this a halt? Would another war start a year later? We do know that he'd done two immediate things in response to Nehru's letter. One, he dispatched an American aircraft carrier battle group to the Bay of Bengal as a visible show of American support. And second, he dispatched Averill Harriman, who is one of the wisest gray-haired statesmen in American history. This is a guy that FDR had sent to London during the Battle of the Blitz and then sent to Moscow during the Battle of Moscow. He sent him urgently to India to assess India's needs. A year after the crisis had come to a head in November 1962, the United States Air Force, the Royal Air Force, and pilots from the Royal Canadian Air Force and from the Royal Australian Air Force carried out a large exercise in India, which was exactly what Nehru had requested a year before. We'll never know the answer to the question, what would Kennedy have done had the Chinese not stopped? But I think that the fact that a year later we carried out exactly the exercise, the Operation Nehru wanted, gives you a lot of indication that we probably would have gone to war in 1962 with China. All of this is, of course, about the past. It's about presidential handling of crisis situations. I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. One of the key lessons, I think, is that the president learned in Cuba and applied it almost immediately to India that government by committee is not a good idea. That the committee will almost always all revolve towards one option. He also learned, be very careful listening to the experts. Listen to the experts you hand-selected for the job. And in this case, he listened to his ambassador in New Delhi, John Kenneth Galbraith, and I think we'll come back to that in a minute. It's also terribly relevant in another way, because to put it oversimplified, and it is oversimplified, but I think it's essentially true, the geopolitics of Asia were set in 1962. The entente, the axis, the alliance, whatever you want to call it, between China and Pakistan began in 1962. It began in Ayub Khan's beginning to think about who was my real ally, Washington or Beijing, Kennedy or Mao Zedong. We've now, 50-some years later, seen this axis develop to the point where China is now clearly Pakistan's number one ally in the world, investing this year $46 billion in Pakistan. The U.S.-Indian relationship has gone through a lot of contours and variations and ups and downs in the 50 years since then. We've had very low moments in those years. But in an ironic kind of way, 50 years later, we're now back to where Kennedy and Nehru were back in 1960. So U.S.-Indian entente, access, relationship, whatever you want to call it, that balances the China-Pakistan. What we've also done in the last 50 years is seen this conflict turn into an arms race that has gone nuclear, an arms race which is today the most dangerous arms race, I think, in the world. because the essential issue at the heart of the 1962 war, the border between India and China, is not settled today. It is the longest disputed border in the world. And while China has a lot of other reasons to develop nuclear weapons and other weapons, one of those reasons is India. And for India, China is its number one threat. In 1999, when the Indians tested nuclear weapons, they cited the 1962 war as the principal reason they needed nuclear weapons. And then they cited China's clandestine support for Pakistan's nuclear weapons. So it's a fascinating piece of history, most of which has been kind of lost over the last 50 years for understandable reasons, and B, a story that's very important, very relevant to Asian American politics today, 53 years later.
Bruce, thank you. It's absolutely wonderful review, not only of the book, but carrying it from 1962 to 2015. I would like, with all of your permission, which I'll take anyway, an opportunity to ask a couple of questions, then we'll go to the audience for their questions. I'm trying to put myself in the position of a president who goes before the American people and the world, 7 p.m. Monday night, October 22nd, 1962, and says, ladies and gentlemen, we are on the edge of something hugely dangerous. I may have to take action against Cuba if the Russians don't do X, Y, and Z. 2 days earlier, the Chinese opened their offensive against India on October 20th. So he knows that. And yet his mind is on the Cuban Missile Crisis. How much did he know at that time? Who were the experts who were kind of feeding him that information? You mentioned a moment ago that a president ought to be able to do these things in a sense on his own and don't get stuck with the wrong kind of expert. But who was the expert at that time? Who was helping him balance these two incredibly dangerous crises?
It's a very interesting question. Because, as you know, we have a multitude of information about the handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The president sped up a special committee, the XCOM, and he taped their deliberations. They didn't know he taped their deliberations, and we didn't know they taped their deliberations until years later. So we have a huge abundance of material about him and his experts. We don't have that same abundance of material about how he interacted with his experts in Washington. But it's safe to say that Dean Rusk, Bundy, and Bob McNamara were in the loop also on the Sino-Indian conflict, but they weren't meeting day in and day out. The real expert and the man he relied on was John Kenneth Galbraith. John Kenneth Galbraith, born in Canada, graduate of the Ontario School of Agriculture, 6'6", that's a conservative estimate. I've seen 6'8".
That's when he stooped.
That's
he was
when
only 6'6".
Right. Famous Harvard professor, wrote some of the most famous books about the American economy and history. Man with a very high opinion of himself. And who let the rest of the world know he had a very high opinion of himself, but who had spent a lot of time in India, wanted to be American ambassador to India, had decided years before that he wanted to be American ambassador to India, and who was, because he wasn't a career foreign service officer or a career ambassador, this was it. He was going to be ambassador to India. That was it. He had an independence that was remarkable, and he seized the day. He realized that Washington was going to be consumed with Cuba. He was going to therefore get very little helpful advice, but also very little unhelpful interference in what he did. And he basically ran it while sending back to Kennedy eyes-only letters for Kennedy on what he was up to. He kept Rusk and Bundy and the others in the loop, but he had a direct channel to the president, and he felt that he had authority from the president to do what he thought was the right thing to do. In addition to that, he had built, by this point in time, a very close relationship with Nehru. And I think it's safe to say that by the middle of this crisis, he was no longer just the American ambassador to the prime minister. He was an advisor to the prime minister. And the prime minister was now looking to him for advice on what to do next, particularly on very tricky issues like how to deal with Pakistan, what to say to the Pakistanis, what not to say to the Pakistanis. And Nehru was giving, Galbraith was giving advice on all of these things. The last thing I want to say about Galbraith is he wrote a diary. He kept a diary of what was going on. And from a historian's perspective, a diary written while the crisis is going on is, of course, the ultimate good source. Because it's not a memoir in which you say, oh, yeah, I played, you know, I was the most important person in the room, because everyone's memoirs say that. It's important what you actually said in your diary on those days. And Galbraith is a great writer, a very witty person. Also, by 2015 standards, extremely politically incorrect. And would write things about people and their behavior which nobody in their right mind in 2015 would put on paper anymore, and certainly not have published a couple of years later on. You would have taken these things out of it. But that diary and all the documents that have been declassified, especially the two letters that I referred to, which have only been declassified in the last couple of years, provide us with a very good basis for understanding who was in the loop, Kennedy's centrality to the loop, John Kenneth Galbraith's critical role in all of this, and what was really going on in the White House in those
days.
But,
Bruce, is it fair to say, and I'm trying to read between the lines here, that Kennedy did not really have major support from anybody in Washington, that he was getting a lot of what he knew about India, about Nehru, from his ambassador?
I think that's so absolutely true.
So if we get to November 19th now, November 20th, and the president has before him two letters, one of them explaining the dire situation in India, and in effect, asking the president to get into a war with China to protect India. Now, I would imagine a decision like that is so enormous because it could lead to a war. Where did the president turn then? Did he go to Congress seeking some kind of authority to move the United States into a war against a foreign enemy? China at that time, in the height of the Cold War, a communist monolith, was certainly not regarded with any kind of sympathy. Therefore, they're the obvious enemy. I, as president, am about to take the U.S. into a war with that enemy. And I do that only on my own? Was that about right?
That's what the record we have, and it stops with the Chinese unilateral announcement, takes us. Or to put it slightly differently, an airlift had begun. We had begun an airlift. We were an active partner in assisting the Indians. He had not gone to Congress for that at all.
But whether presidents have done over the years.
Many presidents
have done over the years.
Right. When he got the letter, he convened a meeting of the National Security Council principals on the night of the 19th. Bundy, Rusk, McNamara, and the director of Central Intelligence, McCone, were all there. We have the record of the meeting. There was pretty much a consensus that we should support India, but also a consensus that we needed to see what they really needed. Whether was this request for all these aircraft really the right answer? And that's why I think he picked Averell Harriman, who he had a lot of faith in, and who the other people in that room had enormous faith into. I mean, I don't think we have people like Averill Harriman around anymore who are that distinguished. But if there's anyone like it, I'd say it's, you know, a figure like Brent Scowcroft or Bob Gates, and send him out urgently to go assess the situation and then give the president the bottom line on what he needed to do. And he did go out, and he did then spend a great deal of time in India over the next few months, and a whole series of initiatives began, one of which I've already highlighted, which was U.S.-Indian military cooperation leading to this military exercise in 1963. Another thing it led to was an effort to try to negotiate a Kashmir solution.
Mm-hmm.
The president had been adamant during the war that there would be no hint of any compensation, and he made that clear to Ayub Khan. But when the war was over, when the ceasefire had went into effect, there was strong pressure in Washington and even stronger pressure in London to try to address the Kashmir issue one way or another. That, of course, in the end, failed to work. Now, the interesting question is, what if we fast forward a week? China's still coming on. It's advancing into eastern India. At some point, the president would have had to do two things. One, he would have had to go to the American public, as he had at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and explain why he was now sending American combat aircraft, if that's what his decision was, into the war. And secondly, he would have had to go to the Congress with some kind of request. My suspicion from looking at the Cuban side of the crisis is that he would have been very reluctant to get the Congress in the loop any earlier than he had to, because as you'll recall in the Cuban crisis, fairly early on, he'd gone and brought in some of the distinguished members of the, mm-hmm. of the Senate and the House, and they were all rabid hawks telling him that this was all his fault, that his weakness had led to this, and that if he'd only listened to them, they would never have been in this position. Since he was hearing that from many of his own advisors, from the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff, I think he'd kind of come to the conclusion that, quote, all the experts and wise men in Washington all seem to line up consistently on the side of doing the most dangerous thing and advocating that because they didn't want to look like they were weak.
Yeah. Oh, I don't want to nail you on this one, but I would like to get it clearly in my own mind. If the Chinese had not decided to call it off on November 20th, and the president had the letter in front of him, would he have committed the United States to active military involvement against China?
I think he would have. I think the cumulative evidence of his strong relationship with India that went back to the 1950s, his belief that India was a democracy and that we needed to help India succeed, his belief that this was an aggressive act by the Chinese, and his belief that the United States had to show resolve, I think he would have. He sent a carrier battle group. A year later, he sent a whole exercise. We'll never know.
Yeah, but it's easy to do it a year later.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy to do it at the height of the crisis. And if he had done it, following your line of reasoning, what do you think the Russians would have done? They had just gone through a humiliating experience in Cuba.
The Russians and Chinese were not coordinating. That, I think we can say without question. Khrushchev and Mao were as much competing with each other as they were trying to confront Kennedy. And both were trying to look more like the leader of the communist bloc than the other. And, you know, one of the interesting things I discovered in doing this is I went back and I read the national intelligence estimates prepared during the early 1960s about the Soviet Union and communist China. I had always had the impression that well into the Vietnam War, the American government was obsessed with the idea of a monolith, certainly the intelligence community wasn't. They had recognized that, this was now a competing Soviet blocs, not necessarily a cooperating Soviet bloc. And they were telling the president that. So I don't think at any point in this crisis, as far as I could tell, did the president look at this and say, is this some master plot of Khrushchev and Mao, you know, pushing me on opposite sides of the world? I think he recognized that he was dealing with two very, very dangerous individuals. The other thing I want to highlight, and you alluded to it, in 1962, we thought the Soviet Union was our evil foe. We thought Communist China was a country of insane fanatics who were, you know, prepared to do all kinds of things to take over the globe. They were, if you remember back to movies in the 1960s, the Russians are always the kind of clever international agent, and the Chinese are this kind of faceless enemy that's inscrutable to all of us. We now know that our perceptions of China were much misguided back in the 1960s. But I don't think there would have, you know, if he'd gone to the Congress of the United States in 1962 and said, Communist China is on the march and we have to fight them, I think the Congress of the United States would have stood up and sung Star Spangled Banner and voted yes. There might have been a couple of holdouts, but as we discovered over the course of the years ahead, 1964 and 1965, in another place, there weren't very many holdouts when it came to...
You mentioned earlier, Bruce, that, we do have a good bit of documentary evidence from the U.S. and from the Indians, but not from the Chinese at all. Is there anything in recent years that has emerged from the Chinese that give us any insight into what happened at that time?
There is, and I should say I'm not a China scholar. I'm working on it, but I'm not a China scholar. But there is several experts on Chinese foreign policy who have recently been looking at this Chinese decision-making process, and I think they've helped us to understand it a lot more. And just to put you in the Chinese perspective for a minute, China had just come together after a century of being in a state of civil war and foreign occupation and fighting the Japanese, and before that fighting European imperialism. In 1951, it took over Tibet. We can spend a lot of time on the legal status of Tibet, but it took over Tibet. The Tibetan people and the Tibetan leadership, led by the Dalai Lama, resisted this, first in a nonviolent way and then in an increasingly violent way. From the Chinese perspective, of course, this was all a threat to the territorial integrity and unity of the new China. The United States supported the Tibetan resistance. The CIA early on began supporting the Tibetan resistance. When the Dalai Lama famously left Tibet and went into exile in India, a CIA team, not Americans, but American-trained individuals, had gone into Tibet and helped exfiltrate him out of the country. One of many of Alan Dulles' success stories to report to President Eisenhower was the morning that Dalai Lama got out, he was able to report to the president in the Oval Office that the CIA had helped get the Dalai Lama out of communist China and into India. We supported them by training them, small numbers, in Colorado, because it was felt that Colorado had the closest geology and geography to Tibet as you could find in the United States. I guess Alaska wasn't counted as a state at that time. And armed them. And we did it with the participation of the Pakistanis. The Pakistani Intelligence Service, at the direction of Ayub Khan, let the United States fly missions to drop equipment and personnel into Tibet out of East Pakistan. You can see that it's very short distance across Indian airspace and Nepalese airspace, and you're in Chinese airspace. This was a great top-secret project. The Indian government was probably aware of some of what was going on. The Pakistani government was fully aware of what was going on. And because a lot of these people were caught the minute they landed and interrogated slash tortured by the Chinese, I think the Chinese had a pretty good idea of what was going on. And from the Chinese perspective, what appeared to be going on was an effort by the CIA to destabilize Tibet, and it was coming from the south. Mm-hmm. I think they assumed India was in the loop on this. The poor Tibetans who were being caught never spent any real time in East Pakistan, so they had no idea where the airbase was, and they were in the way the CIA operates in something like this, you don't tell people anything they don't need to know. All they knew is they'd flown from someplace south of Tibet. Undoubtedly, to some extent, the CIA operation, which had begun in the Eisenhower administration, probably fueled the conspiracy theories in Mao's inner circle, which was prone to paranoia for good reason. He lived in a very, very dangerous situation with many, many opponents, including the United States, including the Russians, including most of his cabinet from one time or another. He saw all of this as an attempt by India and the United States to take Tibet back from China. And he reacted as he did. The exact play of all these things, we don't know because we don't have any archives. I actually, myself, having studied this a little bit, I don't think Mao Zedong had an archive system in which his ideas were, you know, put down in any vigor for the sake of history. If they were put down in any sense of vigor, they were probably adjusted whenever he changed his mind, and all the archives were adjusted to go along with whatever he came up with then. It raises an interesting question. Why did Kennedy let this operation go on? Certainly after the Bay of Pigs, you would have thought that Kennedy would be saying, you know, there's some really harebrained ideas coming from those guys out in Langley. And this may be one of the most harebrained. And Galbraith was completely against it. He thought it was feckless and dangerous. But Kennedy decided to keep going with it. And the best answer I can give you as to why I think he did that is that Kennedy, like a lot of people of his generation, was obsessed with covert operations, with the whole notion that somehow you could, at very little cost, using clandestine means, accomplish big things. It was sexy. It was dramatic. And even after the Bay of Pigs, as I said, he continued to move forward with that.
Well, he certainly pursued that in those years in 60, 61, 62 in Vietnam, when he tried to do essentially that. I'm going to turn to the audience, but I do have one and a half questions to ask about the book itself. How long did it take you to do the book, and what was the most fun part of doing the book?
This book is the most fun I've had in years. if you didn't hear, somebody said, considering the other subjects I write on. Yes, that's true. Nobody gets beheaded in this book. Nobody drives airplanes into the World Trade Center. But more than that, I became interested in this about 3 years ago when I was writing a broader book about U.S. relations with South Asia. And it dawned on me the coincidence of these two crises. And once I focused on the coincidence of these two crises, then I began to say, well, there's a story here. And then, I have to admit it, the glamour of the Kennedy-Camelot White House became intoxicating because it's just so much more interesting than any of the White Houses I actually worked in. So much more style, so much more class. It's not to denigrate anybody, but to recognize that the Kennedys had a very special mystique about them. And John F. Kennedy served only 1,000 days, but go to your local bookstore, go to your neighborhood library, and there are more books about John F. Kennedy than there are about almost any other president except Abraham Lincoln or FDR. He's been a very studied president, and yet this really critical part of his presidency, his finest hour, has lacked one of its dimensions. And that's what I found exciting and interesting to do, is to explore that dimension in all of its all of its colors. And the last thing I'll say there, we haven't talked about this, but we did allude to it in the slides. Mrs. Kennedy, the First Lady, played a very, very important role in his interaction with South Asia over the course of those 1,000 days. She wasn't necessarily an advisor on the night of the 19th, although who knows what they said to each other at the end of the day. But she was very much involved in America's engagement with India and Pakistan. And that's another part of the fascinating story here.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will definitely recognize each one of you raising your hand. Please do ask a question. If you go into a speech, I'll have to cut you off. And I'm really a sweetheart, so don't let me do that. But I see this hand right here. Gentleman, right here, in the middle. Yep, you. Are we going to get a microphone to you? Hang on just a sec.
Yes, the territorial dispute over these, can you put the map up for one more second? Went away just when I needed it the most. the territorial dispute here can be basically lumped into two parts. There's the eastern part. The yellow is Indian territory claimed by China. And the western part, which is the yellow here, is area occupied by Chinese forces but claimed by India. It's actually part of Kashmir. The obvious solution to this problem, and it's been obvious for 55 years, if not longer, is a trade. Accept the status quo. And in the 1950s, the Chinese hinted at this over and over again to Nehru. That kind of trade, dictatorships can do. It's very hard for a democracy to accept that kind of a trade, and especially a young democracy. And Nehru was just politically unable to accept that trade. Despite the fact that the part of Kashmir that is occupied by China has no people. I mean, it is barren, steppe. It's strategically important because it is the main access for entry from Sikyang into Tibet and from Tibet into Sikyang. So strategically, it's very important. But there are no people there. You weren't actually trading away an unhappy population. But Nehru couldn't do it. And the Chinese, over the course of the early 60s, increasingly became more and more clear that they were going to do something. And like most democracies, Nehru became more and more entrenched that he wasn't going to give in, and he began pushing the Indian army forward into positions which were tactically unsound. But Nehru was the father of the country. He was the most revered person in the state. And none of his generals were going to come up to him and say, "Mr. Prime Minister, you're really getting us in a whole lot of trouble." So he had surrounded himself with a court of people who told him he was always right. And he ended up paying the price terribly. in October and November. This crisis devastated Nehru. He was already an old man, but this crisis really was devastating for him. The very fact that he had to go to the imperialists, especially London, must have just been so humiliating to a man who'd spent years and years of his life in prison fighting British imperialism. But he did. The 1950 example of where American forces moved despite Chinese warnings, I talk about in the book as well. And there we had the perfect storm of two factors. One, an American military commander, Douglas MacArthur, who believed that if he was not God, he certainly talked to God every day. And his intelligence chief, a very unusual man, who styled himself like a Prussian officer, which is really kind of weird in the 1940s, since we were just fighting the Nazis. But he styled himself a Prussian officer. He was a big fan of Franco, who told MacArthur whatever MacArthur wanted to be told. And if MacArthur believed that there were no Chinese troops south of the Yalu, there were no Chinese troops in the south of the Yalu. And as a consequence, the greatest military disaster, I think, in American military history occurs. The Indians tried to warn us. The Indian ambassador in Beijing was summoned in the middle of the night to go see Zhou Enlai, and Zhou Enlai said, if the Americans keep coming, we're going to intervene. His warning was brought back to the United States, and Truman and his advisors, and especially MacArthur, said, we're not going to listen to this Indian diplomat. He's, you know, obviously been turned. He's probably a pinko, if not a fellow traveler, and all of those kind of things that people actually said back in the 1950s and 60s, and they were ignored. Lessons here for intelligence are many, I think.
Bruce, I'm going to ask you, because there are a lot of hands up, if you could shorten up your answers just a bit. And I'm going to take the liberty now, and please bear with me, if I ask my brother Bernard to ask a question, since he did cover that war.
As Marvin indicated, I was with the Indian Army at that time in 1962, and in fact was one of the reporters who was evacuated the night of, I guess, October 19th, evacuated by the Indian Air Force from Tejpur to New Delhi, only to wake the next morning to read in the Times of India that the Chinese had declared a unilateral ceasefire. But at the time of the war, there were reports of friction along that border between China and India, scraps of incidents. What was the ultimate evidence that it was China that triggered the grander confrontation? Because India had reasons, too, to enjoy the possibility of benefits if the Indians had poked the Chinese a little too much, and I spoke well. And you alluded to, Marvin is telling me to keep quiet, but you got the question.
He got the message.
Yes, sir. There is a vibrant debate among historians about who is to blame for the China-India war. And I try in the book to lay that debate out. The 1962 version for most of the world was India's a good guy, China's a bad guy. Simple as that. Later historical work argued that China was provoked, that it had tried to signal reasonableness, and that the Indian forward policy of moving troops forward had provoked the war. There's now there's always a new revisionist wave. There's a revisionist wave now that says, all that's true, but the Chinese also had a broader mind, broader interpretation, which was to somehow humiliate India and Nehru in particular in order to advance their geostrategic desire to be seen as the leader of the third non-aligned world. There's a lot of truth in all of these arguments, and I don't... For my point in this book, I don't try to come down on one side or another. I try to lay out all the arguments, because what I'm really talking about is, what did the Americans do? What was the American reaction to all of this? And there's no question that in the Kennedy White House and in the Galbraith's embassy in New Delhi, while they understood the complexity of the underlying dispute, there was no doubt as to who our side was and who the other side was. And that's particularly true because of the kind of black and white, very stereotyped imagery that Americans had in the 1960s about communist China. We didn't make any significant effort at trying to look at the world through Chinese eyes.
Over there. Yes, sir, right here.
Hi, Bruce. It's a pleasure to see you on something other than related to terrorism. As your book suggests, the U.S. doesn't have very long memories, but the actors in the region do. And I'm wondering if there are any lessons we should draw from the historical case study that you've presented here for the U.S. as it seeks to rebalance in Asia and is now trying to help build up India and help manage China's rise.
It's a good question, and I think one wants to be humble to a certain degree here. The events I write about are 50 years ago. The world has changed a lot in those 50 years. But I think one of the lessons that comes through to me is that our tendency in the U.S. government to compartmentalize issues does us no service. One really needs to think about these politics, seeing at least a triangle, if not a quadrilateral. The China-Pakistan axis that begins in 1962 is now matured. The U.S.-India axis, I would argue, is still maturing. It's not as close an entente, but it's moving in that direction. If you really want to, say, find a arms control solution to the Pakistani nuclear arsenal, which, according to David Ignatius, the White House is now thinking about, but you better think about all of these players and how you're going to build a consensus of not just Americans and Pakistanis, but Americans and Pakistanis and Indians, and Americans and Pakistanis and Chinese. That's complicated. That's really hard. But if you aren't playing the chess game, recognizing all of those dimensions, I think you're likely to fail. And I think we've had trouble over the years, and I've participated, I've seen this on the inside, in getting our South Asia team and our East Asia team and our Europe team and our clandestine team to all sit down in the same arena. It'd have to be bigger than Falk, I think, these days, and interact and recognize that a kind of half-baked CIA program to support Tibetan rebels, whatever the wisdom of it as a covert operation, is going to have ripple effects that you really ought to think about well in advance. I don't think we do that as well, and I think in this environment we really need to bring in all of these players and think about them collectively.
Is there a hand right there? Yes, please. And a microphone over here. You got.
I can't help ruminating about any parallels between the situation you describe and the situation in Ukraine now with the Russians invading, however covertly. And I wonder if there are lessons. It appears that Kennedy had much more freedom of movement, although he didn't have to exercise it necessarily. Obama is accused of being a weak leader, but there's a lot more media attention to things. Anyway, I'd be interested in your comments on this.
You know, that goes back to what you were talking about, the role of Congress potentially mm-hmm. in all of this. Do you remember in 1962, congressional oversight of the intelligence community was a complete joke. I mean, once a year, and probably not every year, Alan Dulles went up to the Hill, talked to two or three senators and a couple of congressmen, probably over a large quantity of bourbon, and told them a couple of war stories, and they said, great, doing a great job. You know, come back next year with more war stories. There was no accountability process. There was no you can be critical of the current accountability process, but there is a process. There was no process.
When did that start?
It doesn't really start until the end of the Vietnam War and the investigations in the early 1970s of the CIA.
The Church Committee.
The Church Committee and those things. Then you begin to have a process which you may be critical of, but which does provide some structure to congressional oversight of covert operations. The president also had a great deal of liberty with military operations. As I said, you know, he's begun an airlift of supplies, and there's no record that I found that he ever went to the Congress on this. He also was at liberty in another kind of way, because the Cuban Missile Crisis ate up all the political space, right? I mean, if Pierre Salinger had gone in front of the news media at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis and said, before I get to Cuba, gentlemen, I'd like to talk about India, I think the people there would have, you know, boo, boo. I see one dissenting vote. It was definitely different in New Delhi, but I think in Washington it would have been very hard to get political space to talk about this, particularly in the early days of the crisis, when Americans thought the end of time was facing them in the face. And I'm not saying that Kennedy deliberately took advantage of this, but I think Kennedy was a very, very smart politician, and he didn't see any particular reason to complicate his life. He already was accused. We think of Kennedy now as a strong and decisive leader. In 1962, people thought of Kennedy as the guy who Nikita Khrushchev had kicked all over around the world. He'd kicked our butt in the Bay of Pigs. He kicked the president's butt literally directly in Vienna. The Kennedy administration for at least the first 6 months of 1961 had a horrendous start. One of the reasons why I think Kennedy is such a fascinating figure to study is there's a learning curve here. There is clearly a learning curve there. This president learns from his mistakes. And one of the mistakes that early on he said he would never repeat is he wouldn't listen to quote the experts, because he found out that the experts at the end of the day often had their own agenda, or that if he was going to listen to experts, he was going to listen to the experts that he'd picked for the job, like his brother and like John Kenneth Galbraith.
Gentlemen right here and then behind you. Got 1, 2, 3, 4, a cluster of, oh my goodness, many questions, shorter answers. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhry with National Defense University's visiting fellow at Islamabad, Pakistan. My question is, during 1962 Sino-Indian War, Ayub Khan was the president of Pakistan. And even in 1965, he was the president of Pakistan. And he started a covert or insurgency inside occupied Kashmir for the liberation of Kashmir. My question is that in 1963, when India was preoccupied and engaged in a war with China, why he did not choose that time to launch this kind of operation? Was he independently using his exercise judgment, or was it advised by the Americans, or what Americans involved in not allowing him to get engaged at that point? Thank you.
Kennedy had a very close relationship with Ayub Khan. Ayub Khan came to the United States twice in the Thousand Days. He was wined and dined at Mount Vernon, the only time the first president's house has ever been used for a state dinner. From the beginning, Ayub Khan recognized what everyone else recognized, which was that Kennedy wanted a better relationship with India. And he feared, understandably, that this was going to come at his expense. And in the end, he was right on both counts. We did develop an arms relationship with India. And Kennedy and Galbraith both admitted at the time that the airlift was not consistent with the promises that they'd left with Ayub Khan that no arms would go to India without some prior consultation with Pakistan. There was no prior consultation. There was no prior consultation. There was no consultation with Congress. There was no prior consultation with the Pakistanis. During the war, the president was very clear with Ayub Khan that a opening of a second front against India by Pakistan would be regarded as a hostile act to the United States, and that Pakistan would be regarded as an aggressor, just like China. I think that helped persuade Ayub Khan to stay neutral. I think there were other reasons for him to stay neutral as well, but I think that helped. When the war ended, there was a strong opinion in Washington and in London that now was the time to try to resolve the Kashmir issue through negotiations. Galbraith was one of the dissidents who said this is the wrong time. Nehru is not politically capable of doing a Kashmir deal when he's just been humiliated by the Chinese. And in the end, I think Galbraith was proven right. But through 1963, there was a faint hope that perhaps a negotiations process would go somewhere. I think when Kennedy leaves the scene in 1963, Ayub Khan comes to the conclusion he's going to have to take unilateral means in collaboration with the Chinese. And I think there's pretty good evidence that the 1965 war, I wouldn't say was cooked with the Chinese, but I think the Chinese had seen the menu and had a pretty good idea of what was coming.
Thank you. What I'm going to do is three questions in a row that will be asked. Gentlemen there, then Bruce and Gary. Then we'll go on this side for three. Okay.
I've been talking to Tom Hughes, who was INR director at the time, and as I recall, Alan Whiting was a senior analyst in INR at the time, and his book, China Crosses the Yalu, was a very significant volume. You remember that, I'm sure, Bruce. If that is so, I would think that Whiting and the initial State Department telegram to Bundy maybe reflected Whiting's input. And if Whiting did have the input, you'd think maybe the lesson is that Kennedy did listen to the experts, and that's why he had a better result.
Thank you, Bruce. Why don't the gentleman ask that question next?
Thank you very much for a fascinating story, history. You talk about how Ambassador Galbraith went from just being the U.S. ambassador to almost becoming an advisor to Nehru. I'm going to speculate, and I'd like to see if you care to comment. Might he have had a hand in the writing of those two letters? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Gary, you're the third in this grouping.
Thanks very much, Gary Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. I love the story, and I can't wait for the movie.
We're working on that.
Yeah, well, so am I. As I listened to the story unfolding, and then as you got to the point about how much fun the writing of this book was and the fascination with the Kennedy administration, I'd been thinking all the way through that, and this is a question. I've been thinking all the way through listening to your story and the management of these two enormously difficult issues at the same time, I was thinking to myself, has there been subsequent to that time, in your judgment, another administration that could have or would have handled these crises with the apparent deftness of this administration? And as you comment on that, I couldn't help but think about the current scenario in Syria, where where we now have the entry of Putin. We have the question mark about what Iran will do and whether there is an opportunity to link hands and arms to deliver some kind of reasonable set of circumstances in Syria. And I think I'll leave it there, but I'm really interested in your perspective about whether I think part of what I'm asking is whether you think there is that kind of deftness and nimbleness in this administration.
Okay, you got three questions there, and then we'll get three on this side here. Go ahead, please.
Very quickly. Alan Whiting also wrote another book, which is more particular towards this crisis. He undoubtedly was one of the people that helped cook that State Department memo, and you're right. Kennedy was willing to reach down or have people reach down in the bureaucracy. But I think the real expert he listened to was Galbraith more than anyone else. And just as a footnote, Galbraith's relationship with his putative boss, Dean Rusk, was terrible. Galbraith actually wrote a series of short stories while he was ambassador and published them under a pseudonym that ridiculed the State Department. I mean, they're cutting. Obviously, only a person who the president was protecting could get away with this kind of behavior. I don't think, though, that Galbraith had a role in the writing of the letters, because when you read his diary, and he's very careful in his diary, because the second letter, when his diary came out, was still classified top secret and would be classified top secret for another 50 years after his diary came out. He alludes to it, but there's a sense of kind of shock on his part that he knew Nehru knew he was in trouble, but 12 squadrons of American fighter combat aircraft, I think, struck Galbraith as this is out of proportion. This is too much, and anyway, there's no way we can get 350 combat aircraft and crews here on the ground, ready to fight in the kind of time frame that you're looking at. So he was definitely an advisor. I think Nehru, that second letter from Nehru is Nehru's own hand, written in a panicky environment. And the trick question, which is tempted to get me to say something unkind about the Obama administration, I see through you, Gary. I think there are other presidents, a few, who've managed multiple crises as well as Kennedy. I think FDR falls into that category. His handling of the Second World War is magisterial presidential leadership. It's hard to see that in the last 50 years of something quite of this caliber of decision-making. And part of that is also the nature of the event. Particularly the Cuban Missile Crisis. If Kennedy had gotten that wrong, we wouldn't be in this room. We wouldn't be here. And that's more clear now that we've had access to the Soviet archives than it was even clear then. The Chinese invasion of India didn't have that apocalypse character to it. But these are the two largest countries in the world fighting a war. And while it's now obvious that it was a border war, it wasn't that obvious at the time. There's a part of Galbraith's memoirs where he says an Indian politician had come to him on about the 18th or 19th and said, that she had just been to the Northeast Frontier Agency, and she was reporting that people up there were being told that all of eastern India was going to be turned over to Pakistan. And Galbraith says to her, he doesn't identify her, do you really think the communist Chinese would be telling illiterate peasants on the ground their geostrategic plans for the future? And she, not identified, agrees that, yeah, she's probably been overwhelmed by events. Well, the she is Indira Gandhi. She's the only Indian politician who went there at the time. So while he protected her in the diary, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out who he was talking to. And it's reflective of the sense of panic that was going on. People actually thought the Chinese might take Calcutta. Now, that sounds ridiculous today, but there were people who were afraid that that could happen.
You know, we ought to point out, since you have spoken so incredibly highly of the efficiency of the Kennedy administration, the Kennedy administration did a number of things in Vietnam that, in retrospect, look sort of dopey. But let that go, let that go. Do we have three hands on this side? One, two, three. Yes, please.
At what point did Nehru, who at one time wanted to lead the third world, was it this war that forced him off of that role and perhaps broke his leadership along with Tito and Nasser of the non-aligned group?
Thank you. Number two, right there. Yep.
Can you briefly talk about U.S. positions on Tibet from the 50s to 70s, especially is it a change of policy when in the 70s when India sided with Soviet Union and China joined the camp of U.S. and Pakistan? Thank you.
And the third hand was back there. Yep. Thank you.
I'm really glad that you wrote this book. I've been really interested in this topic since I was a child. My grandfather served in the Indian Army, so he's told me a lot about these events. And I think they're very reflective of the geopolitical issues that are going on today. I was just curious, since in your book you focus on U.S. relations, and I understand this is more looking at the actual events that happen during this time versus what's going on today. Do you see any similarities? Do you see any changes in the present situation? Because so far there's been a lot of mobilization, but on India's side, compared to China where there's been a lot of mobilization, there hasn't been a significant change or in policy. The policy still seems to be very, okay, 50 years old.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bruce, please.
I think this war did break Nehru. He was already old. He came once to the White House during the Kennedy administration. Since they'd already given Ayub Khan this spectacular dinner at Mount Vernon, they had to think of something, you know, at least as good, if not better. So they took him to Newport because Mrs. Kennedy was from Newport and her family home was there. It's referred to as the cottage, but if you've ever been in Newport, you know their idea of cottages are not the same idea as our idea of cottages. But Nehru was unusually silent and tired. He did not respond to conversation. They came to the White House for the state dinner. Somebody forgot to open the flue in the fireplace when they started the fire. The state dining room filled with smoke. It was a disastrous state visit. So Nehru was already past his peak performance. But I think 1962 war with China was really a blow to him. He didn't give up on being leader of the third world. He still aspired to do that. But now he realized that China was going to be his competition, not his friend in that. The Indian Army was in a very difficult situation. The Indian Army was equipped with Lee Enfield rifles, left over from the First World War, if not from the Third Anglo-Afghan War. Mm-hmm. And they were fighting Chinese troops who were well equipped with automatic weapons, many of whose officers had fought in the Korean War. The Indians fought very, very bravely. Indian troops were often outnumbered. They were always out-equipped, but they fought very, very bravely. And it had an impact on a whole generation of Indian soldiers. The one I would highlight to you is Jaswant Singh. Jaswant Singh, who would go on to be foreign minister in the first BJP government, and a real architect of U.S.-Indian rapprochement. Read his memoirs. He saw the 1962 war as the crucible which shaped modern India. And for him, China and the humiliation of 1962 was the critical moment. The 1970s, yes, as I alluded to, this is not a book about U.S.-Indian and U.S.-Pakistan relations. I urge you to read Avoiding Armageddon. I tried to write about that in there. The Nixon administration on India, like on many things, decided that anything that Kennedy had done had to be wrong, and therefore they were going to go the other way. Richard Nixon visited India many times. He always felt he was snubbed, and he was. Indira Gandhi was really, really good at figuring out how to snub people and enjoyed it immensely, and Nixon was one of her favorite targets, and he liked the Pakistanis. But as I said, in an odd kind of way, the journey as it progresses has brought us to a situation where 1962, I think, is very relevant to a lot of today. And what do I mean by that? I don't think there's going to be another Indochina war. I think that's a highly unlikely scenario. I wouldn't be surprised by incidents on the India-China border, but I don't think either one of these countries sees the territory at stake here as worth going to war over. But they do have an arms race. The Chinese may have a lot of other reasons for their arms race, South China Sea, the United States, Russia, Japan. India is part of their constellation. For the Indians, China is the big part of the constellation. As I said, when China tested nuclear weapons in 1999, Vajpayee's letter to the president is all about China. Pakistan is a secondary consideration, and a consideration because it is an ally of China. When India finally in 2013, I can't remember the exact year, tested its Agni 5 intermediate range ballistic missile, which for the first time gave India a missile capable of reaching Beijing. Mm. If you read what Indian leaders said at the time, it's abundantly clear that they see themselves in an arms race with Beijing, and that for 50 years they'd been the loser in that arms race, and that the Agni 5 finally now was an equalizer, that they could nuke Beijing just as China could nuke all of their cities. And I think that this triangle, I don't think there's a prospect of an India-China war in the future. I would not rule out another India-Pakistan war in the future. And if there is another India-Pakistan war in the future, the question of where the Chinese come in and where the Americans come in will determine, I think, an awful plot of the future history.
We have time for two more questions. I would take one on this side and one on that side. The young lady right here. And the right is speechless. No. Go ahead. We'll get you next. Okay, you start. You're next. Your answers, and then we're in business.
Hello, my name is Satine. I'm a student at the University of Utah. And this might be a naive question, but it's certainly been on my mind for quite a while. I'm curious to know why Pakistan and China have had such a strong alliance for so many years. And in my head, as you explain the turn of events, I wonder why China and Pakistan don't gang up on India. Aside, I mean, you mentioned that the Prime Minister had, you know, a relationship with President Kennedy, where he basically said, you know, he would be looked at as an aggressor. But at the time, you know, the United States was very preoccupied, and the Soviet Union was certainly against the United States. Why didn't Pakistan take advantage?
Good question. Yes, right here. Gautam?
Hi. In 1962, I was a high school student in Calcutta learning how to duck under tables whenever a plane flew overhead. But one thing we learned over the years after that is that what you said, that why did China do what it did? And one reason was, of course, the Tibet Dalai Lama connection. The other was the leadership of the non-aligned world. I was wondering whether your book touches on anything internal in the Chinese political structure, because this was right after the Great Leap Forward, in which millions had died. And Mao's position within the party may have been a little shaky, according to some accounts. And whether this was one way of Mao and Zhou in particular to sort of say that, look, we are in charge and don't mess with us internally.
Thank you, Gautam.
I'll flip the order, go right to left. Undoubtedly, there were internal Chinese reasons. Mao also, though, I think there was also a Nehru-Mao dynamic. Nehru wanted to lift up Mao to be his equal in leading the Third World. I think Mao resented that immensely. He was not Nehru's equal. Nehru, in some of the Chinese literature and some of the statements they wrote at the time, which we now know were carefully written by Mao himself or rewritten by Mao himself, Nehru is portrayed as this Anglified Indian who's trying to rebuild the Raj. Now, you know, I understand that for Indians that all seems really cockeyed and worse. But I think to a certain degree, Mao, who was an incredibly paranoid man, probably fell into some of these conspiracy theories. And this was a way to outdo Nehru, weaken his whatever problems he had at home, secure Tibet, and at the same time stick it to Kennedy and Khrushchev all at the same time. It was a win-win. Pakistan. I'll divide the question into two parts. Why didn't they do more in 1962? I think the big reason they didn't do more in 1962, aside from the very, very clear American warnings, was that they didn't really know China either. Their relationship with the Chinese was in its very infant stages. And I think as Ayub Khan looked at Mao, he probably was afraid that if he started a second front, the Chinese could stop the first front, and he'd be left hanging out to dry. By 1965, the relationship has matured enough that now Ayub Khan thinks that if he starts a war, the Chinese will be there to back him up. And here's what's interesting about the Chinese-Pakistan relationship. Chinese and Pakistani statesmen all the time say that this relationship is taller than the Himalayas, deeper than the Indian Ocean. It's an all-weather relationship that Pakistan and China can count on each other. Careful analysis of Pakistan's position in 1965, 1971, and 1999 in the Kargil War is that at the moment of truth, the Chinese usually say, I'm sorry, but I can't hear you. There's something wrong with the line. Call me back. You know, we'll be back to you sometime in the future. They are a strong ally, don't get me wrong. They are critical to the development of the Pakistani nuclear weapons arsenal. But China is not going to sacrifice its national interests for Pakistani objectives. And it's made that clear, I think, over and over again in its history.
Bruce, thank you very, very much for taking a story that is more than 50 years old and making it relevant and interesting. And the name of the book, JFK's Forgotten Crisis, Tibet, the CIA, and the Sino-Indian War. Thank you, Bruce, for writing it and for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.